Hello and welcome. I'm Phil Minot, and it's that time of the week again when we all go
Behind the Bike Shed on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And coming up in today's programme, we look at the Greater Cambridge Partnership Greenways project, and we ask, is £23 million a good investment for free cycleways? As local cycling clubs are starting to get out and about again, we chat to Burwell Bike Club, and if that's not enough for you, we also have our guest on a bike. Film producer Dominic Wade, and he's going to be telling us about his new film, Steel is Real But Carbon is Quicker, which takes a look at the grassroots from which the vibrant and fast-growing British cycling scene has sprung. We're still keeping socially distanced here on Behind the Bike Shed, but I'm delighted to say, as always, we have some good guests for you coming from behind their own bike shed, so to speak. Burwell Bike Club member Judy Brown, who joins us to explain how her club has been getting on during their first club run since before lockdown. But before that, the cycling champion for Cambridgeshire County Council, Councillor Noel Kavanagh, who's involved with the Greater Cambridge Greenways project. Hello, Noel. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Phil. Yeah.
Thank you for your time as well. I understand you're a bit busy at the moment, understandably, with the Mill Road closures. We'll chat about that a bit later if we can. But first of all, can you explain to listeners what the Greenway project actually is?
The Greenways have the intention of making it easier for people to travel in from the villages around Cambridge safely by cycle. If you can imagine a kind of set of spokes going out from Cambridge, these spokes joining surrounding villages from, say, Waterbeach, Horninsey, Melbourne, Barton, Comberton. And the idea is to have safe routes for cyclists, not just commuters, but for leisure cyclists as well. And the underlying theme really is to encourage people to forget about getting in a car and to get on a bicycle, because each of the greenways are not too long. I mean, I suppose one of the longest ones is the one from St. Ives, and that is actually currently functioning very well because it's along the busway, and that busway route for cyclists is hugely successful, bringing in, I'd say, scores of riders every day. Some of them starting from, as I say, as far away as St. Ives and going all the way into Cambridge.
So, Councillor, to interrupt you there. First of all, I mean, there's 12 of these routes planned, aren't there, in total? And the first three have been, well, some are further ahead than others, as you've just explained, with St. Ives one. But three more have been announced, so to speak, further along since consultation. £23 million. Now, that's a lot of money in anyone's way of thinking. How do you justify that sort of cost, on a project like that in current times?
Well, £23 million is not a great deal of money when you look at the amount of money that's spent on highways for motor vehicles. The investment is going to be hugely repaid in the way that if you have more people cycling, they're going to be healthier, which, in fact, is actually a great saving for everybody. It keeps people well physically and mentally, which takes pressures off the NHS. So there's that, I should say, unseen benefits from having that investment. And as I say, it's a small amount of money compared to what is spent on, you know, every mile of highway that's put down.
Now, you are the ward councillor for the Romsey area, which, for people who's not sure about Cambridge, that's literally sort of the Mill Road hub, really, isn't it, part of Cambridge? How do you, when your constituents say to you, why are you spending so much time, councillor, on worrying about people who are living out of town, getting into town, how's that going to affect your ward?
Well, Well, the pressure we have in Cambridge, not just my ward, but across all of Cambridge, is the pressure on parking spaces, to start with, is where people are living out in villages and they haven't got good public transport connections, the only real way they can get in is by using their own private car. And we are all aware of the huge congestion every day in normal times on all the roads leading into Cambridge. And with congestion, you get the pollution, which is poisoning everybody. And my constituents in Romsey are very aware of the pollution. I mean, we've got Mill Road, which is a hugely busy thoroughfare with cars coming in from the east on the way into the centre. We've also got Colden's Lane, which is constantly clogged up with vehicles on the way up to the Newmarket Road and the Beehive and so on. So Romsey residents, in general, I would say, are very supportive of my efforts to actually encourage people who are driving into Cambridge to find alternative ways of getting into Cambridge. And if the numbers increase, that the numbers in using bicycles increase, it's only going to be of great benefit, not just to my own constituency, but for everyone across the city.
Now, you did mention Mill Road, and if you don't mind, where do we stand at the moment with Mill Road and the closures? Because I suspect I would imagine you've got a very busy mailbox at the moment from those who are for the closures and those who are against.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Phil. It's the special measures that have been brought in, and you're probably aware there are 90 across the county, and the county council officers and GCP personnel are working hard to implement these measures, which are there to enable people to keep social distance and healthy during the COVID crisis. And yeah, you're absolutely right. The measures had to go in quickly, and Mill Road has had a bus gate installed on Mill Road Bridge. Ideally, it would have happened in a way where there was plenty of time for having a long period of consultation, but the measure had to go in very quickly. It had to go in so quickly that ordinarily, the main elements to make it successful immediately weren't all there all at the same time. I mean, so first there were barriers put in. The missing item was cameras. So unfortunately, people don't voluntarily do what they should be doing. So even though barriers were put in with signs saying bridge closed, road closed, some vehicles continued to travel across the bridge. But now there's enforcement cameras in place, and people who break the law will be fined. It's a shame that has to happen, but I'm afraid the evidence was that people were not voluntarily obeying the instructions not to cross the bridge. So there's only buses, cyclists and pedestrians allowed across Millborough Road Bridge at the moment. Funny enough, the majority of the people who have been writing into me are supportive of the measures. And there are others who are against it. But counting up my mailbox at the moment, it's something like 60-40, 60% in favour, 40% against. And it was as high as 80% in favour, 20% against at one point. And that was early on. The barriers were the only things in place. But now that people are seeing the benefits of so much less traffic going along Mill Road, and the statements from people about how clear the air is, you know, and people saying that, I mean, a couple of people have said to me, they've even had to ease up on using their devices to help them with their asthma. So there's a clear benefit immediately for people in not having the traffic going along Mill Road. There's also the fact that they are able to keep social distance much more easily because the pavements have been built out at certain points so that pedestrians keep apart from each other as they walk to and from town. And there's also more room for people to sort of queue up outside shops if necessary without impeding people walking along the road. So yes, it's controversial, but it's necessary for public health reasons. And it is also demonstrating what a very, you know, very packed road can be like when it isn't clogged up with congested and polluting traffic.
So that sort of sounds like that's going to long term, that sort of it's happening, it's in place, and we shall see what happens on that because it has a set period, doesn't it, for testing. I would like to mention, though, while we still got you, the elephant in the room, I guess, which is the new Dutch style roundabout in Fendon Road and Queen Edith's Way. There's been a bit of an overspend, hasn't there? I say a bit, it's a massive overspend. Now, I'm guessing that overspend will have to come from other cycling projects.
Yeah, the way the accounting has been done, and at the recent highway and transport meeting, I did raise objections to the way that the overspend on the Fendon Road roundabout was going to have to be sponsored by taking the money from the Cherry Hinton Road Cycle and Pedestrian Improvement Scheme, which I saw as being a very unfair equation. And I think the decision makers heard what I was saying and what other people were saying, and there was an assurance that everything would be done to find the money to pay for the Fendon Road roundabout elsewhere and not to take it from the Cherry Hinton Road Improvement Scheme. But yes, it was a higher cost than originally planned for, but you're probably aware the reason for it was that once the construction was underway, all these utilities which were not known about appeared. So a huge amount of cabling, piping and so on had to be taken out and then put back in and so on. So, but it is quite common with construction of this nature, big, you know, big projects where the budgets do go over, and it's unforeseen elements happen, not just in Cambridgeshire, but it happens everywhere, doesn't it?
Well, look, I mean, I could chat to you all day. Actually, I tell you what, I could chat to you all day about sporting cycling because that's something we both have a passion about, don't we? Thanks for coming in to chat to us, Councillor. As always, we don't have enough time to investigate things further with you.
Thanks very much, Phil. Great to talk to you.
It's much appreciated. Now, coming up next is our guest on a bike. And I suspect as a sporting cyclist fan, as well as an everyday cyclist, Councillor, you're going to like this. It's film producer Dominic Wade. He's going to be telling us about his new film, Steel is Real, but Carbon is Quicker. It takes a look at the grassroots from which the vibrant and fast-growing British cycling scene has sprung. And it features some of the biggest cycling names, such as Pippa York and Sean Yates.
Behind the Bike Shed with Phil Minot on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Our guest on a bike today is Dominic Wade, who is a film producer and also a cyclist. Dominic, actually, you do have connections to Cambridge, don't you?
Yeah. It's Cambridge, as I would say to anyone, is my hometown, and yeah, I went to school in Cambridge, so I know it well, and it's where my interest of cycling began.
So we're going to be chatting about a particular cycling film you have produced, and it's now out and about. It still is wheel, but carbon is quicker. But before that, Dominic, you've done some stuff with Banksy, haven't you?
It would appear that way, yes. I am able to present a documentary that definitely discusses the work of the very elusive artist. So yeah.
Now, I suspect from reading about it, and it looks a good film, Banksy Doco, isn't it? I'm suspect that you probably can't, even if you have made contact with the man himself, you're not going to tell me, are you?
I can't really tell you much. No, I'm allowed to tell you lots of subterfuge, yeah.
So, Dominic, when you were growing up in Cambridge, what sort of cycling did you do?
As most people do, I'd well and truly learned how to ride a bike by that time, because I was kind of 10 or 11. The interest in road racing, and mainly road racing, really, it came from, I remember coming back from the dentist, and a shop called Tourist Cycles had recently opened, and it was just off Victoria Road towards the top end. And I walked past that shop after coming back from the dentist and saw two Eddie Merckx steel bikes in the window. And for some reason, Phil, it sort of captured my imagination massively. But then basically I soon went into Taurus and ended up talking to Mark Minting and Bill Farrow, who set that shop up, and they'd come up from North London, ridden for Highgate, and Bill had ridden for Magnusport and the like. In some ways they educated me about it. And then I joined the Cambridge Town and County Cycling Club, and then the kind of just the further discovery of time trialing, track racing, and road racing was able to develop from there. And I met a wide range of people and went on the chain gang and made some lifelong friends, people who I'm still in contact with now, and some people who I've kind of re-come into contact with because I've made this film. Taurus was, I think, like a lot of bike shops back then, it ended up being quite a central point to the community. The local riders and stuff would just come by and have a cup of tea and chat. The bulk of my education about this sport.
Okay, then. Well, we're going to talk about your film, and you have sort of described really well there the cycling scene as it was when you got in it. And your film, which is Steel is Real but Carbon is Quicker, well, tell us why you filmed it and what it's about.
It's, in many ways, it attempts to tell the story of how this country, the UK, got to Bradley Wiggins, Mark Cavendish, and the other high-profile riders, Geraint Thomas as well. Because Phil, as you just said, when I got into cycling in the mid '80s, it was not how it is now in the country. It was a more obscure, non-mainstream sport. So I was engaging with the likes of Sean Yates and Robert Miller, who is now Philip York, and even people like Camish as well. So the road racing side of cycling is a very European sport and was brought into this country. So anyone who engaged with that a lot was also kind of learning something about Europe. I first went to see the Tour de France in 1990. So you go over there and you start to understand how this sport works in Europe, and then how we took it over to England to some degree in the 80s. And we had, in England, it was pretty buoyant in the sort of mid, late 80s into the 90s. The ANC Helfords team riding the Tour de France in 1987 was a huge deal for this country. Totally English-backed team riding Peugeot bikes, wearing Assos clothing. Assos is Swiss, Peugeot is obviously French. Very colourful jersey, as you just referred to, Phil. The bright colours of 80s cycling is very significant for anyone like me who took it up at that point. So the film tries to investigate how how the likes of Sean Yates and Philippa York and even somebody like Sean Kelly, how they kind of started to lay the ground for the culture that exists now, that Sky and the huge success, obviously, that Bradley Wiggins has had at the tour. And then there's also, to ground the film, there are more grassroots people who compete now, and then also grassroots people who have competed and been involved in cycling since, say, the 70s or the 80s.
Now, I loved your film, Dominic. I had a lovely Saturday afternoon watching it when it was raining, and it's so true, your film, because it really focuses on the late 70s when cycling still wasn't fashionable here in the UK. And you've got people in it, people who at the time, it reminded me what a small community cycling was back there, because you've got people in it like Tony Pinn and John Pearce, Colin Sturgis and Sean Yates, and even some BMX riders whose names I knew. And why did you choose those people?
There was a definite conscious decision to try and choose slightly obscure people, and when I finally decided to approach Sean Kelly, I was like, right, should I really be doing this? Because he's too champion in many ways. But possibly what made Kelly okay is, even though he's a huge champion, he seems to have this huge modest air to him. So he no doubt fitted well, and also being an English speaker primarily, that helped to shape that side of it. But yeah, somebody like Sean Yates, Robert Miller, who's now Philippa York. But if we centre on those two, you know, they were unusual characters who managed to go to France and be very successful. There's all these different elements of Yates, even down to how he had his brake levers very far forward on the bike and stuff, which was not what most riders would. His shorts were like pulled up and stuff. A bit of a kind of English eccentric, and doing okay over there, doing well over there. And then John Pearce, the photographer, for me as well, even more so. I think I always take fun in being able to say to people, oh yeah, do you know what? There's this Englishman, he lives in Bristol, and yeah, he just happens to have, he's photographed the tour for like over 50 years, and he's taken what is always hailed as one of the best cycling racing photos ever, which was taken at the Tour de France in about 81, around that time, and it's a sprint photo with Bernardino and a couple of other. Plancart is another one in the
yeah, about three of them. That's really such a good photo, isn't it?
And that in some ways, if you want to try and sum up to people what is bike racing, it's like, well, just have a look at that photo, and that kind of says it all. So involving people like that, and then Sturgis was of huge interest to me because he became world champion, but also I was aware of the team that he rode for, Team Haverhill, Jackie Harris, and her brother Mark. I used to race and train along both of them, and Jackie rode for Team Haverhill. So when I went to interview Colin, I was kind of like, yeah, Colin, I very much remember you, and I remember Jackie, and Colin was like, yeah, of course, mate. And so the film at times, Phil, gets very personal for me, and I've hopefully sort of evoked that just through what the interviewees have ended up saying without having to put myself directly in the film, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I love about the film as a sort of purist cyclist, if you want, is I love the way that it reminds you of the contrast between the cyclists, as you mentioned earlier, Sean Kelly, who was a pro cyclist, and Philippa York, as you say, was then Robert Miller. But when Philippa talks in the film, she describes the way when how lonely climbing a mountain is.
The thing about climbing mountains is it's a lonely existence. Even if you're in a group, it's still lonely because it hurts. You know, you're not there sitting, it's not time for talking. Nobody's talking, you know, so you're going up them. It's not like riding along in a flat where you can, you know, you can ride 50k an hour and you can still talk. You know, you can sit and you're drafting at the back and you're talking. Okay, the guy in the front who's doing 50k an hour for everybody, he's not talking because he's flat out. It's that kind of lonely existence. And you get, my character kind of got used to being alone, because to do all the things that I needed to do going up through the different kind of ranks and different levels, you were alone when you stepped into that. So I'd leave Britain and I'd be alone. I'd go to France, I'd make a few friends, and then I'd leave them behind. They'd stay at amateur level and I'd move to the pros, and I'd see them maybe once or twice in a year, and you'd still talk to them. But you know, you'd moved on, so you kind of got used to having to rely on yourself.
You look at Robert Miller as she was then, now obviously Philippa York. She came down from Scotland, from Glasgow. managed to get down, you know, to France. That, you know, ACBB is the hugely iconic amateur team that fed riders into the Peugeot team. And Yates was there, and Alan Piper, an Australian, and also Phil Anderson as well. So, but yeah, just understanding how somebody like Robert Miller, who was not traditionally destined for that type of career at all, but somehow found cycling, and then as she clearly said to me, it gets understood that somebody like her is understood to have talent, and that is spotted, and then that is worked with, and that is what facilitated her being able to have this career. And Phil, yeah, the point of how lonely it feels to climb mountains attempts to sum up, it sums it up pretty well, I think, of what it must feel like to be a pro in the Tour.
Now, we must stress, though, the film, it's not just a course about professionals, is it? You've also got, for example, the bicycle collector who lives in the Isle of Wight, Chris Weston. And he's just obsessed with equipment, Dom.
Yeah, no, I mean, as you know, I became, as lots of us do in the modern world now, I became aware of him via Facebook, but yes, I think specifically via 80 Cycling Remembered, which is like a very sort of nicely sort of romanticized Facebook group about the appreciation of 80 cycling. And so Chris, yeah, was kind enough to share his collection of bikes, one of them that I obviously used in his interview, which is a Colnago Master.
Yeah, beautiful colours. Love the mint and white, isn't it? Looks gorgeous.
Yeah, because sadly Chris has passed away now, and so that's why the film is tributed to him. But yeah, his bike collection was like 40 or 50 bikes.
Dominic, now on observation, and it's not a criticism because I think it's a reflection of where cycling was at the time, there are very few women in your film.
Yep, and that's why I was very keen to have Emma Sainsbury Munn, newer person to cycling, but has had a good amount of success being a world champion at master level, and also and doing that with the track discipline, and the track discipline has quite a lot of history. So it was good to have her, and then Philippa York, you know, kind of indirectly.
Yeah, of course. And but you know, I think it sort of demonstrates as well not only how hard was it for individual males to make it in cycling at a top level, but it was almost impossible for women, wasn't it? Even though there were many women in cycling clubs back then.
Yeah. I mean, you know that. I guess they truly were just like the odd one or two. Jackie Harris being one. Mandy Jones. And you see, and Mandy Jones gets described as like she was accidentally world champion at Goodwood in 82. You know, it's like you're not really meant to accidentally become world champion, but it tries to sum up that, you know, that the sport was so different.
You're listening to Behind the Bike Shed here on Cambridge 105 Radio, and I'm delighted to say my guest today is Dominic Wade, who has produced Steel is Real but Carbon is Quicker. If you're into the history of cycling, then sort of recent history of British cycling, then this really is the film for you. It's a very absorbing 90 minutes back-to-back detail and content. I loved every second of it. Dom, now this is the time in the show where you get to play...
Let's play Spin That Wheel.
I believe so, Phil.
Great. It's our 3 minutes of Spin That Wheel. Cambridge 105 Radio.
Spin That Wheel.
Dominic Wade, what is your earliest memory of cycling?
I reckon riding round on my at my grandparents' house on a Gresham Flyer. That is where I learned how to ride a bike.
What type of cycling do you enjoy most?
Road riding, definitely. Yeah, just being out for a good 50, 60 miles.
And how often do you cycle?
Absolute minimum once a week, and kind of up to a maximum of, say, three or so.
Are you a member of cycling club?
Yep.
Which cycling club's that, Dom?
I am a member of the Bristol Road Club.
Oh, that's quite an old club, isn't it? That goes. That must be about 100 years old, isn't it? Now, I guess.
Yeah. It's one of the traditional ones.
That's what I thought. What sort of bicycle or bicycles do you currently pedal, and which one of those is your favourite?
I've got a Carbon Merx from 2015. I've got a Steel Surly from 2015, and then I've got my three old steel Tauruses: the winter bike, which needs quite a lot of work to get it back up and running. The track bike, which I rode the National Track Championships on, that's pink, it's been resprayed, that still works well. And my old steel best bike. And in some ways, Phil, from the old romantic side of it, there has to be the old steel best bike. It would be, if I had to pick one.
Ah, so steel slightly gets the edge if you're over carbon. Saddlebag, pannier or rucksack, which is your preferred for carrying stuff on your bike?
Pannier, you said, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, unless you don't use any of them, of course.
I don't really use any of them, but I would pick panniers if I had to.
Oh yeah, I suspect for you it would ruin the contours of your bicycle, wouldn't it, and how it looked?
Yeah.
Something hanging off it. What would be the perfect dream cycle ride for you? Whereabouts in the world would it be, and with whom?
Perfect bike ride.
Mm.
I reckon. It's one I've done a few times. It's from my uncle's house in southwestern France in the Tarn. It goes to a small village called Varb. There's one section that's about 21, 22 kilometres, and it rises steadily through a valley. So it would be that ride. Who would I take? If I could take, I suppose I would take Sean Yates.
Yeah. What's the longest distance you have ever cycled? I tell you, actually, I'm going to change your question. What's the highest mountain you have ever cycled up, Dom?
That will be Mont Ventoux, I reckon, yeah.
Oh, that's a hard one. And what's the longest distance you have ever cycled?
I reckon that was a Cambridge-based... No, not... Sorry. Yeah, kind of a Cambridge-based ride. It was the Dunwich Dynamo that started in East London at Eastway, the track where I used to road race a lot. And with Terry Dickerson, we rode to Dunwich.
Oh, you just got it in. You wrote a Dunwich. Now, Dominic Wade, I could chat to you for hours about your film and all the people you met and all the different characters, and we really have just scratched the surface here. Steel is real, but carbon is quicker. Dominic, how can listeners watch your film?
Listeners can enjoy the short version, which is about 7 or 8 minutes. Go to my website, madebywade.co.uk.
Okay, and we'll put that link on the Behind the Bike Shed Face page. Dominic, thank you so much for your time. It's a great film. Take care. Looking forward to your next film already, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Behind the Bike Shed with Phil Minot on Cambridge 105 Radio.
My guest joining me now on Behind the Bike Shed is no stranger to the programme, and Judy Brown from Burwell Bike Club is here to chat to us about the first club runs they've been running since lockdown has been lifted. Judy, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you very much. Good to be joining you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for agreeing to join us here. Now, you're one of many cycle clubs around the country who haven't been out on club run since, I'm guessing, back in March. But you've just literally, in the last couple of weeks, you have restarted your club runs. How have they been going?
Well, they've been going very well indeed. In fact, our last run on Sunday, we had three groups of six and one group of four go out. So in total, 22 riders. So we were very pleased.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the group sizes there. Now, they, to me, sound a lot smaller than what they would usually be.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we would probably have maybe 8 or 10 in the groups, trying to match people with similar abilities and speeds and distance. And we found that having groups of with 6, that included the ride leader, was actually manageable and in fact very enjoyable indeed.
That's interesting you say that, the smaller group numbers are better, because on the continent, quite often, their cycle clubs tend to be a little bit more informal than ours on a Sunday run, and they'll tend to meet as a group at a cafe. They tend to have a cup of coffee first before they go out, but then they split into smaller groups as well, and they've been doing that like for years. Now, I guess the problem with a smaller group, if you're a cyclist, it's going to be harder to hide in the back of a group, isn't it?
Yes, but we, the Burwell Bike Club, I mean, it's a community cycling club, and it's really to encourage a love of cycling, and we welcome all levels of ability and embrace all types of cycling. So we're not, you know, we're not going fast, we're not going long distance. The Sunday ride was 25 miles for one of the groups and 18 miles for the other. So, you know, we find those are good distances for encouraging people to join us.
How did things happen then using the new guidelines?
Well, what we did, we have a Facebook page, and we created a couple of events and asked people to accept the invitation that they were coming. So we were worried that people might just turn up on the day, because we had to ensure that we had sufficient ride guides available. But actually, everybody signed up who wanted to come. They turned up, and it was quite straightforward. We put some guidelines on the Facebook page, letting people know that we would actually be starting in 2 different locations, so that we weren't we're trying to avoid large group gatherings. And we also mentioned that there would be no coffee stop, but that we would arrange to have a social break at a suitable place. So on Sunday, we stopped at a park. We encourage people to bring refreshments, and we had a social gathering on our own, but not at a coffee stop this week.
You got me a bit worried when you said you had no coffee stop, but then fortunately you've made up for it, because you did still have a social break with hopefully some cake for people as well. Because, as you mentioned, the thing about Burwell Bike Club, like a lot of cycle clubs these days, it really is, isn't it? It's about enjoying cycling and going for a ride with your best friend almost.
Well, that's absolutely right, and you know, we all appreciate the benefits of cycling, whether that be physical, social, mental, wellness, and in particular the breaks, the breaks where we can stop and chat and have coffee and cake. I'm sure in a few weeks' time we'll be back doing that, but with venues just starting to open, garden centres and coffee shops. We thought that they would be a little bit too busy for us on a Sunday, and we thought we would just try and keep distance just for a few weeks more.
Now, I have to say, because, before COVID and the lockdown, I was lucky enough to be invited out to Burwell Bike Club to one of their club evenings, and it was really worth making the distance, you know, making the effort to go out to the edge of the fens where you were. And I was a bit worried because it was nighttime, and I'd heard about some of your members for other people. but that is such an important part, isn't it, of the Burwell Bike Club, I suspect, the social side.
Yeah, and we missed that during the lockdown. I myself missed it. I'd been cycling out on my own, or maybe with one other person. So I was a little bit nervous, I suppose, about how it was going to go riding in a group again. But oh, it was well worth it. It was really good fun, and you know, the social aspect and being in a small group, being able to chat with people as you cycle. As I say, we were putting no pressure on anybody. There's no racing. It is just out in the countryside. And of course, Sunday just gone was a glorious sunny day.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Bike Shed. Just to let you know, you can sponsor this or any other programme on Cambridge 105 Radio. Email sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
Judy, you mentioned club and how social it all is. But you yourself, I mean, you've done a few cycle rides, haven't you, of great distance?
Oh, yes. In fact, it was a year ago now, I went with a friend over to Morocco and cycled in the Atlas Mountains. But at the moment, I'm enjoying the Strava challenges. There's an endurance challenge out at the moment, which is to cycle 1,600 kilometres a month. So another member of the club and I are, you know, halfway through that. So that would be, you know, about 250 miles a week is what we're aiming to do, and thoroughly enjoying it.
But generally, then, it sounds to me like the Burwell Bike Club is almost there like a hub. People like yourself, or perhaps less confident cyclists who aren't doing such big mileage, you can just sort of meet up once in a while, maybe once a week.
Yes, that's right. We have a club ride on a Sunday morning, and we also have Wednesday mornings, what we call coffee and cake break, where, you know, it might be 10, 15 miles. And then during the summer months, we have a Wednesday evening ride. You know, we hope to be able to put on more rides between now and when the clocks go back. But it all depends on our volunteer ride guides. You know, if we can get people on board to help take the rides, then the more rides we can put on. And we're working on that at the moment to try and put on a wider variety of rides as possible to suit those that might only want to do 10 or 15 miles, but also those that really want to put the distance in, maybe 35, 40, and even 50 miles.
And if anyone's listening who lives in the Burwell area and they're thinking, oh, this sounds like a friendly club, I might join this bunch, how do they go about doing it?
Well, if you can find us by searching on Facebook, the Burwell Bike Club, and then there are a few questions that, if you want to join, that we'd like you to answer. So basically confirming that you live within a 15-mile radius of Burwell, and you know, what sort of mileage you do, and also to accept our club rules. But you know, it is for locals to get involved, and there's no membership fee, and we welcome anybody, you know, whether or not you just want to join socially or whether or not you want to actually partake in one of our rides. We welcome everybody.
Thank you so much for joining us, Judy, and safe cycling.
Thank you very much.
And if you live in the Burwell area or 15 miles of it, I suggest, and you want to join a cycle club, I suggest you check out the Burwell Cycle Club. But don't forget, of course, there's lots of cycle clubs springing up all over the county in various villages, and we shall be featuring some over the next few weeks here on Behind the Bike Shed. That's it. Can you believe it? The finishing line is fast approaching. Just leaves me to say thank you so much for my guest today. A special thank you to Councillor Noel Kavanagh. Thank you very much to Judy Brown as well from Burwell Bike Club there. And a special thanks to our guest on a bike today, Dominic Wade. Don't forget to check out his film on YouTube. And if you'd like to contact the programme, well, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us here at bikeshed@cambridge105.co.uk. Alternatively, you can contact the show and indeed follow us on Facebook at Behind the Bike Shed on Cambridge 105 Radio. You have been listening to Behind the Bike Shed. It's a Barking Hound production for Cambridge 105 Radio. The voice of Spin That Wheel was Tony Barnfield. I'm Phil Minot, and until next time, say cycling.
Behind the Bike Shed on Cambridge 105 Radio.